right now, we have an old radio theme to set the scene for my first guest. We are the boys from Down Under, which I think was the theme music to a radio program called With the Boys Overseas, messages and reports from the New Zealand Division sent back by the Mobile Broadcasting Unit, which followed the troops, the New Zealand troops, through North Africa and Europe during the Second World War. The historian and sound archivist Sarah Johnson has been looking and listening back to the work of the unit, and she joins me now. Kia ora, Sarah.
Kia ora, Brian.
I vaguely remember hearing that. When it was first broadcast, but I'm sure I've heard it in other documentaries about the New Zealand Division. There was something. It's quite sentimental hearing that. Actually, for me, quite a sentimental response just hearing that just then.
But it was a bit of a hit song of the day. So it was released in 1940, and then the program With the Boys Overseas began sort of late 1940, but then it really got going in early 1941. The broadcasting service had to expand programming to accommodate the demand for material that the mobile broadcasting units were producing from Egypt at this point. And so it was on every Sunday morning. People, it became, we use the phrase appointment listening now, and I think it became very much something that people tuned into. It was then repeated again on Tuesday nights. And it was expanded later on during the war. I mean, I'm talking about my research about the unit that was based in Egypt and travelled through North Africa, the Middle East, and then Italy. But in 1943, there was a second mobile unit which went into the Pacific with the 3rd Division. So that went to New Caledonia and Solomon Islands and got up as far as Bougainville and Booker and some of the, really remote islands of Papua New Guinea where the fighting was there. So what I've really been interested in over the past few months is trying to establish, what the response was from New Zealand radio listeners to these recordings that were being sent back by these broadcasters. And what's come through sort of loud and clear is really what the New Zealand radio public during the war wanted to hear was or were the voices of their boys overseas, were the messages home that the broadcasting unit recorded. And the demand seems to have been almost overwhelming, I think, for the broadcasting unit. Just once they started this thing, it kind of snowballed.
Whose idea was it to send a broadcasting unit with the troops?
It seems to have been initiated, as far as I can tell, by James Shelley, who was the first Director General of Broadcasting. He was the head of the Broadcasting Service. Whether it was his own personal idea, I'm not sure, but the first inkling I have found of it so far is when he writes to the Minister of Broadcasting and writes to the government, and this is in early 1940, saying, I think we should send this unit overseas. It would maintain morale of both the troops and the New Zealand public, and it would be a way of keeping the public in touch with their men. And they would, the plan was that it was pretty broad, the proposal, but they would make these disc recordings, because this is the era before magnetic tape recording for sound didn't come in until after the war, really. So they were making recordings on disc, and then they were going to send them back to New Zealand for broadcast. They were also going to as much as possible, use shortwave radio to broadcast more timely material like news reports of the war or action that the New Zealanders were involved in. That was going to come back via shortwave radio, and in the end that ended up happening courtesy of the BBC. The BBC's shortwave service was listened to hugely in New Zealand, and the New Zealand broadcasters, who really became our first broadcasting war correspondents, they ended up doing a lot of work via the BBC. And that was a huge leap forward for New Zealand media, really, and for the New Zealand listener in terms of the immediacy of getting news from the other side of the world. Suddenly they could hear a New Zealand broadcaster, you know, a voice that they recognised. They were fairly experienced broadcasters, the men who went, talking about New Zealanders in action, and you know, on occasion when it was something pretty big like Alamein or Casino or the Victoria Cross being awarded to a New Zealander, they could hear that news from the other side of the world within 24 hours, 48 hours of it happening. So that was a huge, you know, leap forward in technology. So that's a whole other aspect of the mobile unit's work that I'm really interested in as a former journalist myself. Yeah.
Well, how do they actually record? It's difficult. I mean, a lot of people, younger listeners might not even know what magnetic tape is, barely know what that is, let alone. So how do they record the soldiers?
So if you imagine, they were recording them on acetate or lacquer discs, which basically look like an LP. They're sometimes a bit bigger, but instead of being made of vinyl, like an LP is, they were made of, they had a core usually of aluminium, but sometimes of steel or glass or even cardboard, which was then coated with this lacquer. And then it's called a lathe, the recording lathe. So they're recorded on something that looks like a turntable, but instead of the playback arm, you have a sapphire-tipped needle which etches the sound into a groove. So it's the same principle, really, as an LP, I guess, but this is actually recording.
It's going in reverse.
Exactly. So they pretty much kind of over-engineered the tech for the first unit. They built, at the Petone Railway Workshops, they built a recording caravan, which had these lathes mounted in it, and it was kitted out with all sorts of tech that they thought they might be able to use. And then when they eventually got to Egypt, got this thing off the ship, then they had to wait, because it was just the caravan body, they had to wait for a truck to arrive from England so that they could then mount this caravan on the truck. And they quickly realised when they saw the kind of country they were having to travel through and the speed at which they were going to have to travel to keep up with the New Zealand division, that this truck was just too slow. The army didn't like it. It was too slow. It was too big. It was too obvious a target. So what they ended up doing is they got permission from New Zealand to buy a car, and they bought this Ford Mercury sedan, this big, big sedan of a car, and they used portable disc recorder, so something like about a suitcase sized affair. Again, it looks like a turntable, but it's equipped to cut these discs. And so they use the car and the portable recorders a lot more often than the big caravan. They did use the big caravan for a few trips, but it was just a bit, and they took it to Italy and used it in Italy, but it was really just a bit slow. So by the time the second unit went off to the Pacific, they realised that travelling light was much more the way to go, and so they just sent them off with disc recorders, portable disc recorders, and the guys who were in the unit in the Pacific ended up being able to travel by barge to some of these remote jungle-covered islands where, you know, the Japanese and the Americans and the New Zealanders had been fighting, and they really got into some remote areas because they were travelling that much more lightly.
And did they have conventional microphones, and did they record people? They try to make a studio, or people recorded outdoors?
They were recorded outdoors. There's some fantastic photos that the Turnbull Library has. Official war photographer took some great photos of the mobile unit guys in action. And they were recording outdoors, so they would have, they would run a cable from the disc recorder, which would be probably kept in the car, or if they were using the big caravan affair, would be running, the cable would run back to that. But yeah, the, you can see in the photos they're using microphones, and you know, they're identifiable as microphones. Occasionally they've got some strange looking, you know, sort of pop socks or canvas bags. It looks like they've jerry-rigged up to cover the top of the microphone, well, probably in a, an attempt to keep the sand out.
I'm looking at one, Sarah, which is which we've got from you, which we've put on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/nights. And one of the members of the unit appears to be holding what looks like a rolled-up tea towel. And there's a troop, he's reading out something he's written, a member of the troops, and there are a whole lot of other blokes lined up behind him. I assume they're all lining up to have their little chat. How long did they get to talk?
Very little time at all. And so this was kind of first imagined by the broadcasting service and by the broadcasters themselves, that this was going to be just a sideline. It was kind of a filler that they would get some guys to send greetings home. But as soon as the New Zealand public heard these messages, suddenly everyone wanted their son, their husband, their boyfriend to be on the radio as well. And there was this huge demand for these. And so it became kind of, it dominated a lot of their work. So how, the way it worked is they would contact different units. They had to visit all the different units in rotation. They would contact the commanding officers and say, right, we'll be in your area next week. Can you please organise 30 men? You know, and they got chosen by ballot. So the way the men were chosen was nothing to do with the broadcasters. And they would have to write out a little message. There were printed little slips of paper. The men had to write who they were greeting, you know, their name, where they were from, what their message was going to be. And then it had to be checked by a censor or an officer acting as a censor, just to make sure they didn't say, oh, we're getting ready for the big push, or, you know, we've just got a whole lot of new tanks, or you know, nothing that could be of use, obviously, to the enemy. And so the messages, you know, when you listen to them, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them, they are very generic sounding. And, you know, some of the guys just are very tongue-tied. Obviously, you know, being on the radio was a very new thing for most people. And so, yeah, they're very generic. But as they discovered, it was not really the content that was so important to listeners. It was the fact they were hearing that loved one's voice. They were hearing, you know, their son on the other side of the world. And, you know, you couldn't make an international phone call. All you could do was wait for letters, really.
And how long did letters take?
Yeah, well, weeks. They could take weeks. I mean, it took the discs weeks to get back to New Zealand. So, yeah, mail was slow.
Yes, because I assume they still had to. Did they ship them or fly them back? Do you know?
They could fly them early on, but then when Singapore fell, Singapore, because, you know, international travel, air travel at this stage was a lot of short hops for refueling. And so you had, you know, there was multiple stops between Egypt and New Zealand. And then and Singapore was kind of the key place. And once that fell, then they had to go by ship all the way to sort of Western Australia, and then they could fly. So it did take a number of weeks. Sometimes they tried. I've seen correspondence in the research I've been doing that they tried going via the USA at one point, and yeah, it was just a bit of a logistics nightmare.
Sarah, I've got a couple of examples here that I really want to play.
Oh, good.
This is actually I don't think it's a spoken message, and I'll ask you about it after we hear it. I think it's a waiata.
Oh, my baby,
members there of the Maori Battalion, Sarah. Wasn't that amazing?
So that was an interesting recording, and I need to do a bit more digging about who those performers are, because that was from Christmas 1940 in Egypt at a YMCA concert. And the main body of the Maori Battalion was still in England at this point. So those men, I suspect, are part of perhaps a forward party that had been sent out to Egypt, or they may have been Maori who were serving in other units. So at the moment, all we know is that it is obviously Maori performers, Maori men who were in Egypt at Christmas 1940. But the mobile unit was asked to make as many recordings as they could of the Maori Battalion, because the demand was such from Maori communities who wanted to hear their men. In my research, I've come across letters from the minister who was responsible for coordinating the Maori war effort, and he writes to the broadcasting saying, you know, I'm being inundated with letters from Maori who want to hear their men more often. And so the broadcasting service then telegrams the guys in Egypt and says, please record the Maori Battalion whenever you can. And the broadcasters in Egypt reply, well, we would, but, you know, we've got to actually be where they are to do this. And, you know, if they're in action, they don't have time to sort of sit down and chit-chat into a microphone. And plus, they've also got all these other units who are demanding to be recorded. So I think one way they kind of got around it was to record Maori Battalion in concert, and they would make these concert recordings outside the sort of normal rotation so that they could kind of squeeze in a few extra greetings along with the concerts. And so we get some fantastic recordings they've made of the Maori Battalion in concert in Egypt in 1941. There's another great one of the Maori Battalion in concert in Italy later on in the war. I think it's in 1944. And they're just fantastically atmospheric. They're amazing recordings, and they're some of the real taonga of this collection.
Sarah.
And I should say those Maori Battalion ones are all available on the Maori Battalion website. That was sort of my introduction to this amazing collection of recordings, was looking for material for the Maori Battalion website back in 10 years ago now, probably. Yeah, so they're fantastic. Also, if you go Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision is digitising all these recordings, and they are progressively being uploaded to their website, so people can listen to them there.
Sarah, we've got less than 2 minutes, and I want to squeeze in this recording, which was made in the Pacific, I think, by that second unit that was sent there. Can you tell us in about 20 seconds what we're about to hear?
So this is an absolutely typical example of the sort of messages hype. So you can just imagine a program full of hundreds of these sorts of messages every week, twice a week, sometimes more throughout the war, these sort of greetings.
Next message from Reg Clarkson goes to Auckland.
Calling all the Clarksons, Mum, Paul, Joyce, Peter, Gloria, Claude, Albie and Lois. I hope you're all well and looking after those bellows of mine. Calling all my friends of the Auckland Motorcycle Club, I'm looking forward to a reunion before long and some more good riding together. I'm doing pretty well, have gained some weight and also a good tan, but have yet to discover the romance of the islands we are told about. Cheerio all.
Ken Max calling Mairangi Bay, Auckland.
Hello to Mum and Dad at Mairangi Bay. Hope you are both well. This is Ken calling from the Swaying Farms. If you are listening, Catherine, keep your chin up, honey, and I still think you're the swellest little lady. My regards to your dad and Epsom. Hello, Marion, Jim and Barry, and the two Bettys I know, with Keith and Ethel and Peter John. All the best. Cheerio.
Greetings from two New Zealanders serving the Pacific. Sarah, thanks so much. Very, very briefly, in about 10 seconds, where can we go to hear more of this, see more of this?
You could either do a search on Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision's website, or I have a blog, worldwarvoices.wordpress.com, where I write about the recordings and what I'm finding out about them.
Thanks so much, Sarah. It's been lovely talking with you.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Johnson, sound archivist, talking about the Mobile Broadcasting Unit.